for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. When poet, playwright, and essayist T.S. Eliot died in 1965, Life magazine mourned the passing of the Age of Eliot. Best known for The Wasteland, Eliot changed course in the late 1930s and wrote a set of poems he called Four Quartets, a deeply spiritual meditation on time and the path to redemption. Eliot considered it his greatest work. Joining me for this month's Reader's Review of T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, David Gewonter of Georgetown University, Jewel Spears Brooker of Eckerd College, and Anthony Kuda of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's good to have you all with me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion. And I should alert our listeners, you're going to be hearing T.S. Eliot read some of the Four Quartets. Jewel Brooker, if I could start with you, just tell us a little about T.S. Eliot. I know he was born in 1888, right there at the turn of the century. What was happening in the world? What was going on in his own life?
T.S. Eliot was born in St. Louis and of a very distinguished family from the Boston area. His grandfather was one of the founders of Washington University, a missionary, Unitarian missionary, actually, to St. Louis. The context of his upbringing is really the entire legacy of the 19th century. The subjectivity of Romanticism, the Darwinian burst that brought about the social sciences. He returned to the East as a student at Harvard at a time when one of the main projects of the university and of intellectuals at large was trying to integrate the Darwinian and scientific insights into the humanities. And he studied at Harvard. He went abroad and studied in Paris. He studied at Oxford. And he intended to come back to the United States and perhaps be a professor at Harvard, but was prevented by the war, and he married an English woman and became a man of letters in England.
Jewel Spears Brooker, she's professor emerita of literature at Eckerd College. She is author of a number of books, T.S. Eliot, The Contemporary Reviews, and T.S. Eliot and Our Turning World. She's co-editor of Volume 1 of the forthcoming The Complete Prose of T.S. Eliot. David Gewonter, how did T.S. Eliot come to write the poems contained in Four Quartets?
Well, he was writing Murder in the Cathedral, and he had several lines that he and his director sort of agreed weren't really fitting, and they became the basis of Burnt Norton, and he started to compose from that in the 1930s as the sort of drumbeats of war were coming in. And the poem Burnt Norton has five parts, and I think it was going to be called the Kensington Quartet, because he was living in Kensington at the time. And so it's he started this long, somewhat abstract meditation on time and the self as war was coming in and as many troubles were starting to reach London and the sense of peril was coming upon everyone.
And Tony Kuda, how did Beethoven work his way into the quartet?
Well, I think Elliot was always an admirer of Beethoven and the late string quartets, but he was also an admirer of Béla Bartók and his quartets. And he said, actually, while he was working through the second of the quartets, I want to stop to mention that this was, the quartets were, David suggested, the quartets were almost a kind of accident. They began with these lines that were discarded from Murder in the Cathedral, but that Elliot liked too much to get rid of. So he stuck them at the beginning of this new poem. And he composed Burt Norton, which we're going to hear and talk about, and put it at the end of his collected poems in 1936. So this was a standalone poem that was meant to be the end of a thing. And when he started to think about the later poems, the idea became that he was going to pattern them on similar models as the earlier ones. And that's when the idea of a quartet came to mind. And in fact, he wrote to a friend of his, to John Hayward, around the time, he said, "I should like to indicate by using this musical analogy, I should like to indicate that the poems are all composed in a particular set form." So the idea of a quartet was really more a matter of allowing the words to reach a kind of musical resonance, I think, rather than, scholars, of course, will argue, but rather than a kind of homage to Beethoven.
So tell us about the first quartet, Burt Norton. What does that meant to stand for?
Well, the title of each of the quartets is a place, and that's an important imaginative catalyst for each of the poems, a place with personal and historical resonance for Eliot, but the resonance kind of falls away. And in Burt Norton is an English manor house 2 hours west of London in Gloucestershire. So it's in a beautiful English countryside. You can go and visit it today, and as a matter of fact, if you join up for the International Eliot Summer School, you can go every year at the beginning of July. They visit, in addition to 10 days of lectures, they visit 3 of the 4 quartet sites in England. It's a fantastic and wonderful opportunity. I think Jewel may actually be there lecturing this summer. Again, accidentally almost, Eliot was staying with a woman with whom he had long been attached, had a long time relationship, Emily Hale, a long lost love of sorts, in 1934.
This is after he has been married.
That's right. This is after he has been married for 20 years. His marriage has gone downhill and he has left his wife. And he is re-establishing a relationship with Emily Hale. She's visiting him in England at the time. The two are staying with her family in the English countryside, and they take a walking tour, and they come upon this abandoned manor house called Burt Norton. And really what's more important than the manor house are the gardens. They walk through these beautiful formal rose gardens into this area where there is a drained concrete pool, and that's where this imaginative vision, this kind of waking dream comes of the life they could have led.
Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage which we did not take, towards the door we never opened into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind. But to what purpose? Disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves, I do not know.
And, of course, that is T.S. Eliot himself reading from the first quartet, Burt Norton. And, Jewel, it would seem that time is so much in the forefront there as he reads that poem.
Well, absolutely. Time is the overarching topic of all the quartets. To pick up on something mentioned by both David and Tony, this throwaway from Murder in the Cathedral came at a point in the play when Thomas was tempted to return to King Henry II and resume his place as archbishop, to go back to a point in the past and to create a different present, really. And this is exactly the situation that Eliot was in with Emily Hale. And so it starts with this meditation, which triggers this. He met Emily Hale in 1913. She was interested in the theater and, in fact, became a professor of theater at Smith and at Scripps College in California. And he was with her. They were just tourists on this occasion. But there are several references in the opening scene to that visit, and the might have been children, and all of the might have beens, of course, are abstractions. They were there in September of 1934, early September, the very beginning of September, and there are references in the opening scene to the autumn heat. The roses were in their second bloom, but the autumn heat becomes a sort of metaphor for late-blooming love as well as late-blooming roses.
Jewel Spears, Brooker, Anthony Kuda, David Gawanter. We're all here to talk about T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. Stay with us. And welcome back in this, our April Reader's Review, which is, of course, Poetry Month. We selected T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And we have some readings from each of the quartets. Interestingly, Burnt Norton, which you just heard, East Coker, The Dry Salvages, is that the correct pronunciation?
That's it.
And Little Gidding. I wonder to what extent high school, college students are reading and enjoying T.S. Eliot today, David.
Well, Ted Hughes, when T.S. Eliot died, said, I felt like I'd just gotten a crack on the head, followed by an instant headache. And at the same time, he said he was a slightly disapproving father and he had to figure out how to move on. And it's a little possibility that students today may see Eliot as the disapproving father at the table and telling them that their youthful interests and indiscretions are going to be leading to eternal damnation, which not every undergraduate is eager to hear.
What do you think, Tony?
I teach this poem a lot, this poem and Eliot's other poems as well. His first poem, J. Alfred, Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, is incredibly compelling in the classroom. But I think a sure way to provoke kind of dumbfounded stares of intimidation and silence is to present a poem like Four Quartets as a profound philosophical meditation on time and time. And I think probably more, what that's how it was presented to me originally in college.
And of course, that's how he sounds.
It certainly is how he sounds, right. But it is really a much more powerful poem when you consider it as the portrayal of a speaker's struggle with what to hold on to and what to let go of. Because time for Eliot is really about change. It's about, and change is about, again, what slips through our fingers. And I think the entire poem, each of the quartets, is deeply concerned with the idea, the question, do I hold on? Do I value the things that are around me? And does that bring me happiness? Or is more happiness, does more happiness lie down the road of dispossession? If I let things go, if I am free of the kind of values and possessions. So I think that's at stake in every one of the quartets. And that's a powerful way for students to think about it.
Jewel.
Well, I teach the quartets a lot too. And I don't find that students resist the poem. One reason is that Eliot juxtaposes the individual, the personal, the very intimate with these. He juxtaposes them with these big philosophical issues, and the two. One way of reducing the themes of the poem, and in such a short time, we have to reduce them, but. He deals with two aspects of our lives that students can understand quite easily. The first has to do with our duality, with the fact that we're mind and matter, soul and body, that we're full of contradictions, and that this is part of the human condition. This goes all the way back to the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock and Eliot's early debates between body and soul. And connected with that, and also part of being human, is the fact that we long to solve these things, and we're always trying to, and we never quite can do it. So trying to resolve these puzzles without ceasing to be human is something that students deal with all the time. The other thing that students deal with, that first part that I was talking about, I think has to do with what we are as human beings. The other big thing that all students can understand is the reason they're in the university is how we know. And this poem deals how we know in time. We know by toothaches, by heartaches, we know by what's all around us. But we intuit, we know that there's a bigger picture and how to connect this intimate personal experience with the big things that matter. This is one of the big things in quartets. And Eliot shows this over and over by juxtaposing his own experience in the Rose Garden with a meditation on the big picture.
David.
Well, this is very well spoken what everyone is saying about valuing the things around us and also understanding about dispossession and what we're trying to hang on to. We were talking about students and what they think of it. It's a strong commitment to go into these poems and to go into the kind of philosophical discipline and education that it takes to follow where Eliot goes, his references, the echoes that we find from many other poets and voices that come in. I really appreciate what Jewel's saying about putting students on the spot and having them look at their own kinds of choices. And it's not only toothaches and heartaches, but many other aches that they're having.
Let's talk about East Coker, Tony.
Sure. Well, East Coker is the second of the four quartets, and it, as we said, is really the first of the four quartets, insofar as it was the first time that Eliot realized he was writing four quartets. These poems weren't published as the first part one of the four quartets and part two. They were published in pieces, and when East Coker was published, Eliot realized, well, this is going to be a sequence, right? And it is based on East Coker is a village in Somerset. It's about 3 hours outside of London, and it is the home of Eliot's distant ancestors. So it is a kind of connection, a kind of ancestry and heritage linking him to England, a place where he was for a long time an expatriate and not an English citizen until 1927. And there he has another waking dream or vision of this kind of pastoral, rural countryside, people dancing in a marriage ceremony. And the vision seems to be idyllic and kind of calm and nostalgic, but then suddenly dies away, kind of drifts away, and Eliot is forced to ask, what comes from these things? What really comes from holding on to ceremonies, to people we love, to places, times, and ancestries?
Because his answer they is all turn to ash.
Because everything falls away, right? And mm-hmm. and the poem is going to be a process of asking, what happens if I let go on purpose?
Let's hear it.
Oh, dark, 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 they all go into the dark, the vacant interstellar spaces, the vacant into the vacant, the captains, merchant bankers, eminent men of letters, the generous patrons of art, the statesmen and the rulers, distinguished civil servants, chairmen of many committees, industrial lords and petty contractors, all go into the dark. And dark the sun and moon and the almanac de Gotha and the stock exchange gazette, the directory of directors, and cold the sense and lost the motive of action. And we all go with them into the silent funeral, nobody's funeral, for there is no one to bury. I said to my soul, be still. And let the dark come upon you, which shall be the darkness of God.
It's almost a sense of his own death. Dark, dark, dark. Am I overemphasizing that, Tony?
I don't think so, except that it's a sense that everything passes, right? It's a sense of death as things passing. The history has passed. Yesterday has passed. But you know, I think it's important to, again, this is one of Eliot's great characteristic traits, to weave in seamless allusions. The first words of this stanza, dark, 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 are actually an allusion lifted right from Milton's 17th century poem, Samson Agonistes, when the biblical hero Samson was blinded and shorn of his strength, his hair, by his enemies. And Eliot in this passage turns this incredibly painful moment into an exemplary moment in order to show us how things pass. And then he turns and says, I said to my soul, be still and let the dark come upon you. In other words, he's not running from the disappearance, the dispossession, the sense of surrender. He wants to turn and embrace it and say, I've tried the path of vision, of dreaming, and of possibility. Now let's try the path of surrender.
Jewel.
Each middle part, the middle part of each quartet, has two parallel journeys. One journey is a journey in time, and that is going into the dark. And he includes eminent men of letters, which he is at this time in that. The other one is a descent into the self, a descent into the darkness. That descent, which in a way is takes you out of time, can only happen in time. And so we have this meditation here on really on how to redeem the time, how to use the time in such a way that everything is not lost as you go into the dark. Mm. As you go into the dark, what you do minute by minute and what you can experience at these intersections when time ceases to exist are ways of holding on to something. And this descendant, this descent, always has to do in the quartets with disciplined meditation, with memory. These are characteristics emphasized by one of his main sources and inspirations, St. John of the Cross, who felt that in the 16th century, who said that the ascent to God and the ascent to self-knowledge really involves disciplined meditation and a descent into the self.
David, how religious a man was T.S. Eliot?
Well, he was born and bred in the midst of Unitarianism, as he said, but it was recorded that he saw Michelangelo's Pietà in Rome and fell on his knees. And many people take that as a kind of moment of a visible conversion. I think he lived with the prospect of death and the fear of death and what would come after death. Like Sam Johnson, he was a man of the city, but sort of haunted by the prospect of death and damnation. You can see in this passage, listing all these people, it's a kind of Dantean journey, going through all the people of your life and seeing them later on, seeing their second selves, their dead selves, come back to you.
But then he's also almost talking about Wall Street and the stock market and sort of bringing in these real-life structures to the idea of these ethereal figures.
Well, the one thing I wanted to mention is that Eliot was living in London at the time. Eliot lived in London for most of his life. He was living at this time. He was by this time a well-known poet, the poet of the wasteland. He was also working at Faber & Faber, the publishing house, so he was also a kind of guide to up-and-coming poets and authors. But, you know, he had separated from his wife, but wasn't living in kind of a posh bachelor's pad in London, right? He was living in a small, secluded room in the clergy house of St. Stephen's Anglican Church.
By himself, not with
Emily. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Not with Emily, no. Emily was a kind of a far-off possibility. He was living in this room because he was a church warden. So he's living here next to the clergy of the church. He was living in isolation and in dispossession.
And dealing with all of his own desires and
desires and guilt for having left Vivian, and also a vow of chastity that he had taken when he converted to Anglo-Catholicism in 1927.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So he's there living by himself in this sort of self-inflicted isolation. He must be very unhappy, and yet he's pouring out this poetry.
Well, I think Eliot's religious sensibility was actually most comfortable in a state of danger. That is, I think he grew up in the Unitarian Church, where basically, as he described it, you simply said your prayers, did your good deeds, and that made things okay. You'd go to heaven. And Eliot's sense of religious devotion and responsibility meant you had to live your life as if every day was to be your last, almost, in severe and profound devotion and meditation and self-questioning. And so to be at this edge with a sense of intensity and demand and danger, I think, for him was part of what the religious journey called for.
Jewel, are the poems meant to be sequential?
Yes. Well, as Tony said, the first poem was written as a standalone poem. The others were conceived during the war and just before the war. The first one was published in 1935, the others 1940, 41, and 42, and then the entire sequence as a whole. But they're definitely meant to be a whole. And a quartet when Eliot is, he uses the musical analogy in part to bring them together. A quartet is a piece scored for four instruments, not necessarily a piece of four movements. It's a four in one. And the four instruments, so to speak, are the four elements. He uses earth, air, earth, fire, water, and fire, the four seasons, and the four places, and the parallel form in each quartet. But mainly, I think, for for general reading. It's the theme and variations.
Interesting.
Because all of the quartets work on the same themes with variations.
David, how does four quartets fit in terms of the lexicon of English modernist poetry?
Well, there's an arc that you might take from Eliot's The Wasteland, the famous fragmented poem of five parts that is a reaction to, variously his reaction to the Great War, World War I, and a reaction to a broken marriage. And so in some ways, the soul in stress is both personal and domestic, and looking more widely cultural. Eliot, as World War II is coming on and as London is being bombed, thousands of people killed at night, and he is there coming into London and serving as a fire warden, which is a little different than a church warden. It's to keep the fires off your buildings and so forth. And so amidst that kind of terror, he is seeking this kind of meditation, philosophy, and discipline. It's quite strong, and it fortifies him at a time when everything looks chaotic.
David Gewandter, he's professor of English at Georgetown University. When we come back, we'll open the phones, take your calls. I look forward to speaking with you.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, David Sedaris returns. He has a new book called Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Sedaris writes about his life, but
there's the you that you present to the world, and then there's, you know, of course, the real one. And if you're lucky, there's not a huge difference between those two.
We'll maybe get to some of the differences. Join us.
And one of our listeners has reminded us that a production of Eliot's final play, The Elder Statesman, opens in Washington, D.C. this week. How timely. Let's go to Casanova, New York. Good morning, Aaron. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. And I'm very fascinated with the subject. And, you know, poetry and people like T.S. Eliot, you know, and Ezra Pound and such, you know, bring interesting associations. In my mind, I'm thinking about two of my favorite authors, Woody Allen and Allen Ginsberg. And probably the introvert of Eliot and the extrovert of Ginsberg in Howl, you know, it's probably an obvious comparison contrast. Woody Allen, I'm reminded of the scene in Annie Hall, I think it is, where the young Woody Allen is brought by his mother to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist is asking Woody Allen, well, why won't you do anything? And he says, well, the universe is expanding. You know? And I don't know if you remember.
I remember that.
Right. And so the psychiatrist says, why is that important? And his mother says, no. And Woody Allen says, well, you know, why do anything? What's the point? And I can't help but that when I think of that, when I think of the self-absorption of the T.S. Eliot.
What do you think, Tony Kuda?
I appreciate the call. I think probably self-absorption is the wrong word, because Eliot's religious devotion was such that, you know, it was incredibly demanding, both spiritually and emotionally, but that he was also an incredibly active individual, both in terms of the time that he spent helping other poets and the talks, lectures, and contributions that he made to dozens of charitable societies around London. So he was really a man of the world as well.
David.
Well, I love that movie reference that Aaron made, and I think the psychiatrist was smoking as he was telling him how long the universe was going to last, so there's a little edge to that. But one city that Eliot didn't really cover too well was Paterson, New Jersey. That's not quite a city. Mm-hmm. It's a big town. But out of that comes William Carlos Williams and Allen Ginsberg, and neither of them were much persuaded by Eliot. And didn't feel that Eliot's vision of the world was reflecting their own experience and how poetry could engage and render it.
Interesting. Here's an email from Evron, who sends what he says is a comment about his favorite quartet. He says, "Where is the knowledge? We have lost in information. Where is the wisdom? We have lost in knowledge." He says, this quartet is more and more relevant to today's digital age. I think that's rather interesting that he makes that connection. Let's go now to Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, Randy. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I think Eliot was having not only an emotional relationship with God, but a literary love affair with the Bible as well. The poem East Coker, the second quartet, is so biblical in its language, and there are so many biblical echoes, like it begins with, "In my beginning," whereas, of course, the Genesis begins in the beginning. And then you hear echoes of Ecclesiastes as you go further down in that first paragraph. He says, "A time for building, a time for living, a time for generations, a time for the wind to break the loosened pain." I hear in that Ecclesiastes, a time to sow, a time to reap. And that same kind of repetitive use of the word time. In fact, I wonder if his whole absorption with time harkens back to Ecclesiastes, which is such a beautiful poetic section of the Bible. And I hear so many mimetic references. And I'm wondering how your panel feels about that. And after they've had a chance to comment, I'd like to ask a question I've always wanted to know the answer to that has to do with Eliot, and I don't know if they can answer it or not. But,
all right, all right.
Back to me in a second, okay?
Okay, go ahead, Dave.
Well, certainly the callers, Randy's quite right about all the echoes of the Bible and how that's being used and put forward. Jewel mentioned meditations and spiritual disciplines, and I think that's often what Eliot is looking at. And sometimes they come out of sermons, Lancelot Andrews and other people who are involved in the oratory of the Bible. So,
and you can easily get to the word prayer, can you not, Jewel?
Absolutely, you can. And the question is a good one, though, and the observation is a good one. Burnt Norton, the opening line of Burnt Norton, time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, is also an echo from Ecclesiastes. In chapter 3, there is a verse that says, that which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. Hmm. And there are other references about time. There will be time for dancing, a time for darkness, a time for light, and other biblical references. But yes, prayer is very important in the quartets, particularly in the last three. The fourth part is a sort of prayer. And the fourth part of Little Gidding is actually a sort of theodicy or an attempt to deal prayerfully with the problem of war and evil.
All right.
Recognizing always, I think, that for Eliot as well, always recognizing that the words aren't going to do it, that words alone are simply an occupation of the mind and that they're going to fall away. And at one point he says, the poetry doesn't matter. So this is a poet using words to approach something divine and to approach an intense struggle, but realizing that words, prayer, meditation, all of that falls away when you reach the darkness of God.
Oh, dear. And Randy, I'm sorry I've lost you by mistake. If you want to call us back, I'll try to get to your second question.
The overwhelming question. Do not ask us.
I want to hear about the dry salvages because, first of all, it's named for a group of rocks in the North Atlantic near the Massachusetts coast. I gather it's where Eliot spent his boyhood.
It was, yes, Diane. He was born in St. Louis, as Jewel reminded us, but spent almost every year, almost every summer with his family in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And he learned to sail off the coast there. The Dry Salvages is a rock formation, as you said, near the port of Gloucester. And he learned very quickly by learning to sail and from listening to fishermen that these rocks were incredibly dangerous. And in fact, that's what he says, that in a storm or in difficult weather, when it's dark, you can't see them. They're really only about 10 or 15 feet above sea level, but there is an immense formation below sea level. So they represent, I think, in this poem, a kind of perpetual risk and danger, right, of running oneself upon the rocks. And for Eliot, that was, again, part of the spiritual life, the pain and danger.
The river is within us. The sea is all about us. The sea is the land's edge also, the granite into which it reaches, the beaches where it hints of earlier and other creation. The starfish, the horseshoe crab, the whale's backbone, the pools where it offers to our curiosity, the more delicate algae, and the sea anemone. It tosses up our losses, the torn seine, the shattered lobster pot, the broken oar, and the gear of foreign dead men. The sea has many voices, many gods and many voices.
Can you see those dry salvages?
You can see them. I've actually, and I'm sure Tony has too, taken boat trips out to see them in good weather. Eliot's use of the rocks and the water here are very significant. This is in a way a memory poem, but a reflection poem. But he uses the river, the Mississippi, as a symbol of this movement in time that he's concerned with, and the sea as a symbol of the timeless. And in the first part of Dry Salvages, more than in other parts, he actually talks about the different kinds of time, about the subjective time of the anxious women and wives lying awake at night, wondering when the night will end, of the time that's older than chronometers, of the time between midnight and dawn, of Chronos, Kairos, the right time, subjective time, eternity.
David.
Actually, I almost have a question for Jewel because I'm delighted in what I'm hearing. What happens with the bell then? I mean, the time is going on, and we're having these, the sense of time in the sea is very different than land time. And then the bell rings. Is that the end? Is that put across time?
No, I think the tolling bell is the bell, you know, that is constantly ringing. The tolling bell measures time, not our time, rung by the unhurried groundswell, a time older than the time of chronometers, than time counted by anxious, worried women lying awake, calculating the future, trying to unweave, unwind, unravel, and piece together the time in the future between midnight and dawn. I mean, he's dealing with historical time, mm-hmm. with time out of history, but still in time, with Kairos, the right moment in time, with eternity, with all these sorts of times that are bound into the human condition.
Tony.
Well, I was just thinking about some of my favorite lines in this poem. We've talked a lot about the philosopher Eliot, the religious poet Eliot. The lyric poet Eliot in these poems really shines through in very simple and straightforward lines that I think poets, any poet today would strive to emulate. Right after we left off with that passage, "The sea has many voices, many gods and many voices," are these beautiful lines. "The salt is on the briar rose. The fog is in the fir trees." That beautiful lyrical moment, perfectly stated. It could be prose, but it's not. It is a perfect lyrical moment that I think we forget to the detriment of the poem.
Anthony Cootey, he's professor of English at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of The Passions of Modernism, Eliot, Yeats, Wolfe, and Mann, and co-editor of Volume 2, of the forthcoming The Complete Prose of T.S. Eliot. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go quickly to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Surely.
And for this wonderful topic. I was hoping to bring up Eliot's expatriate days in Paris when he palled around with Hemingway, Joyce, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ford, Madox Ford. The key figure for the success of all of those authors was Ezra Pound, who was arguably the greatest poet of that time and possibly in American literature, who himself was a fascinating character. He was actually arrested and kept in an insane asylum for about 12 years, and all the aforementioned authors tried to come to his aid. Wasn't Ezra Pound, doesn't Eliot resonate from Ezra Pound, and Ezra, of course, is the reason all of those aforementioned authors were so successful.
All right, Tony.
Yes, Eliot was a great friend of Pound. It was Pound who was instrumental in publishing Eliot's first poetry and his first book. He remained a longtime friend. Pound was an extremely demanding friend, however. He played a great role in the revision of The Wasteland, but he was extremely demanding, so much so that when Eliot was a publisher at Faber & Faber, he once told someone that he spent probably more time answering letters from Ezra Pound than he did working on forthcoming books. But he was an incredibly important presence in modernism and for Eliot.
Now, let us speak a bit about Little Gidding, because we're almost out of time, and I do want to hear T.S. Eliot read from it. Go ahead, Jewel. Tell us about this poem.
Well, this is, in Eliot's view, this was the greatest of the quartets, and the sort of the poem that brought all of the things together. He did visit Little Gidding, which in 1936, he was there in May, which is very important, alluded to, referred to actually in the first part of the poem. Little Gidding is a community north of Cambridge, which in the 17th century was known for its sanctity. A committed group of Christians retreated there, and it was there during the Civil War that Charles II came when he was fleeing from Cromwell. But the context of Little Gidding is the Second World War.
All right.
We shall not cease from exploration. And the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown remembered gate, when the last of Earth left to discover is that which was the beginning, at the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick now, here now, always. A condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, and the fire and the rose are one.
And that, as you've reminded me, was read at Margaret Thatcher's funeral, Tony.
It was, and it's a beautiful passage filled with hope and possibility. David talked to us about that at the break. It's a demanding hope, a hope that is going to take a struggle and a search.
Tony Kuda, Jewel Spears Brooker, David Gewandter, thank you all.
Thank you
so much. And for our next Reader's Review, The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach, story of a college baseball star. I think you'll enjoy it. Join us Wednesday, May 29th. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.